This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to this special bonus extra episode of Slate's Audiobook Club. I'm Katie Waldman, a staff writer here at Slate, and I am in the DC studio. I'm joined by two very special guests today. The first is a senior editor at Slate, Jeremy Stahl. He's calling in from the Golden State, from California, and he knows a lot about politics, so that will that bodes well for our discussion, which we will unveil in a second. But hi, Jeremy. It's really nice that you can join us.
Hi, Katie. I'm really happy to be doing this.
And our third panelist is Ava Lubell, who is the general manager of Slate, and a lawyer, and in general, a tactical genius. Also, that will bode well for our discussion. Ava, it is great to have you here.
I am so happy, really honored to be here. Thank you for the tactical genius remark. I'm not sure that's at all true, but I'll live it up.
You'll have a chance to prove yourself.
I will second tactical genius.
Oh, thanks, guys. Yes.
Great strategist in the field.
Before we get started, I'd like to do a quick program note, which is our official April Audiobook Club will resume, obviously, at the beginning of the month in April, and we are going to read Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. So please stay tuned and join us for that discussion. So we have convened to talk about Sun Tzu's The Art of War. It's a pamphlet written more than 2,000 years ago, possibly in the 6th century BCE in China, by Sun Tzu, who was a military scholar, among other things. And we're going to see if we can apply any of this manifesto's lessons to our lives in 2017. So the book is broken into 13 sections. Each section consists of a numbered list. They're kind of aphoristic entries, little drops of advice. So I guess I'd like to start by asking both of you if any of Sun Tzu's suggestions resonated for you personally. So, you know, now that you're well-versed in the art of war, have you practiced it without realizing? And are there things that you're going to take away from this book going forward? So maybe, Jeremy, I'll start with you.
So I'll start off by saying I bought this book, and you don't need to buy it. It's public domain. It's everywhere. But I bought this book within a week of Donald Trump's presidential election and felt like, I was in probably a place of just personal and professional and general disruption and desperation. And feeling like, you know, this book has this popular image, I think, in popular culture as being like sort of maybe a handbook and guidebook for the generous way to think about it would be the incredibly savvy, but the other way to think about it would be like sociopaths. And seeing Trump's election victory made me feel like, well, okay. Maybe they're onto something, or not necessarily maybe sociopaths are onto something, but maybe I want to know how the people who embrace this in such a way, business leaders, generals, politicians, how they might think. And, you know, in the popular imagination, those are the types of people that are interested in this. So I like bought it. And I have to say, I don't really know that any of this applies to my actual life. I can see looking at it in the topics I cover, politics and the law, and specifically politics and the law in this moment, how I can observe and think about how maybe political actors are thinking in ways that Sun Tzu might have advised. But personally, the best advice that I could take away from this was number 18, I can't remember in which section, was if you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles. I feel like that's generally good advice. Know your adversary and know yourself. And that's one that, yes, from a common sense perspective, I'm trying to practice more. I want to know myself better and also, you know, the adversaries. And I will say one last thing on this, which is that Trump has said explicitly that he considers journalists or the fake news, as he calls it, and he lists off a number of fake news outlets such as CNN, The New York Times, et cetera, NBC News, as the enemy, quote unquote, of the people. So he has taken this incredibly adversarial viewpoint of journalists. And I think it's only fair and sensible for journalists to respond in kind. And I wouldn't say that from an ideological perspective even, but just from a perspective of journalists are seeking truth. And Donald Trump, to me at this point, based on so many of his actions, is an enemy of the truth.
Well, what about you, Ava?
Well, I came to this book kind of looking for tips, to be honest, because a lot of my day is spent negotiating. Not that negotiation always needs to be war. I don't think technology contracts require that level of aggression. But, you know, it's interesting to hear different perspectives on this, because usually when I go into a negotiation, I always try and start from the nicest place possible, from a place of, you know, assuming collaboration. And there, you know, there's something in the air right now where that kind of seems to be a really flawed strategy, at least on the political front. So people keep saying, oh, okay, like, you know, Democrats, when it comes to a judicial nominee, they're giving Gorsuch a hearing. They're not fighting tooth and nail. But the other side is constantly fighting. So like, maybe this idea that I'm going to be really nice and collaborate, which probably like no one has ever found me a collaborative person before. So this is at least what I strive to be. I don't know that anyone ever receives me that way. But maybe that approach is not right. And of course, early on, right away, Sun Tzu says, you know, all warfare is based on deception. And I, you know, I was struck by that because I think, you know, at least in the modern professional world, we assume, okay, transparency is this inherent value and everyone should try to be as transparent and communicative as possible. And the notion that somehow we, as, you know, a more civilized society has no idea how to combat some of the more pernicious sides of a Trump administration, it's, you know, because we're just like not playing by the same rules. And, you know, we don't believe in this notion that all warfare should be based on deception. And we don't believe in scorched earth strategies, which is something else that Sun Tzu talks about later and the value of that. But, you know, what if the other side feels that way? So that's kind of my first impression. Like, well, maybe I need to be rethinking how I do my entire job.
Yeah, I mean, I also was not, you know, I read things like never attack uphill. And I was thinking, okay, great. Next time I'm like playing capture the flag, I will know not to directly attack uphill.
You're but a good runner though, Katie. So maybe you have the leg strength.
I don't know about that. But I do, I mean, this is also a book that, as you both have mentioned, has been embraced by the sort of combative or at least hungry Silicon Valley types. I think I saw a report that Evan Spiegel of Snapchat bought copies for his six-person team or his six-person management team, at least, after he met Mark Zuckerberg in an elevator and felt incredibly intimidated and said, wow, I need to sort of remake my perspective about like how to deal with competitors. And I think maybe had the same come to Jesus moment that you were referring to. But I do think also that idea that deception is the heart of warfare really interested me, because it wasn't really valor or moral uprightness or even honesty, like purity of spirit is the heart of warfare. It's really this quite Machiavellian perception. And I do think like that is significant that right now in 2017, that's the kind of value system that we are turning to as like somehow more relevant to where we are.
So he's got the section on, you know, one of the principles, the key like four or five principles described is the moral law. And when you hear those words, we have a certain understanding of what that means. It means ethics and, you know, trying to do the right thing. And for Sun Tzu, the moral law causes people to be in complete accord with their ruler so that they will follow him regardless of their lives. So it's about control. The moral law is control in this world. And he follows that up by saying, you know, the commander, the person who is in control, stands for the virtues of wisdom, sincerely, benevolence, courage, and strictness. So the ruler who is, you know, the moral law is meant to guide the people to follow is supposed to be a good one, but that's not what morality and the moral law, even just by its plain definition, means. And I just want to say, like, when I was talking about sociopathic, that was a very ungenerous description. But like in my understanding and imagination coming into reading this, like those are the popular culture figures that you know, have been depicted as big art of war fanatics. And I'll list off some people that I knew about beforehand and also like did Googling on and found to be big art of war fans and or have fictional characters as such. And Patrick Bateman is one. Tony Soprano loves the art of war. Who's another one? Gordon Gekko. Gordon Gekko in the film Wall Street is, he says, I don't throw darts at a board. I bet on sure things. Read Sun Tzu, The Art of War. Every battle is won before it is ever fought. That's good advice, but it's also like advice from the guy who is winning the battle before they are fought by cheating.
Although I would say that's the strategy of a lot of prosecutors, not to make this super boring and legally, but, you know, people keep talking about Pre-Bara, he's in the news all the time. And if you've, you know, ever talked to someone who's like a really excellent prosecutor, they'll say, we never prosecute a case we don't know we can win because we've done all the mm-hmm. prep work before. So that's like an interesting modern day application for our yeah. modern day warriors, that you like preparation. That seems like a real thing that he does harp on, that there seems to be some logic yeah. and foothold there.
It's really good advice. And it's also followed by another one in my list, which is who has cited it on multiple occasions and cited this book. And that's Bill Belichick of the New England Patriots, who is also like a dark arts master in the view of most people, including me.
Does like Barney like Sun Tzu? Can we get, is there anyone?
Mr. Rogers loves Sun Tzu. But I do want to push back a little bit on the notion that this is an immoral writer, because I think he's amoral. He's endlessly pragmatic, but there's no evidence of bloodlust or sadism here, right? Like one of the points that he keeps sounding, and I did actually just side note, find this beautiful and poetic, but also quite repetitive in a way. Like there were a few main themes that he just kept attacking from different angles, which maybe speaks to his idea of what an attack is anyway, because I think that he actually talks about assaulting a foe from different angles as well. And he does that to his argument, which I thought was neat. But one of the things that he says is repeatedly is that supreme excellence is in breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting. And so his ideal war is actually a war in which they never even pick up the sword. And it's averted. And he also says that rapidity is of the essence. You want to get in, get out. No one benefits from a prolonged engagement. And so there's a real distaste for conflict, for violence, for the hell that is war, and a clear-eyed, I guess, recognition of that.
No, I agree with you. There's this notion of preservation, and preservation mm-hmm. of his men in particular kind of makes you wonder what we get to the point where war is already a foregone. What about, you know, I almost wonder what he would think about when people are making the decision to go into war in the first place.
Mm-hmm. He also talks about, there's a line in there, and I can't remember the specific line, but it is like the wise leader who is well-versed and knows the bloody costs of war and is aware of what it costs both a kingdom or whatever and the people.
In my notes, I have a reference to Bond villains because there is something like you're not supposed to divulge your plans to anyone. I was like, well, Bond villains do all the time. That must be why they lose.
Yeah. Well, that's another interesting point, like to take his kind of beautiful lyrical language and make it not so lovely. he basically says, when the enemy thinks that you're going to zig, you need to zag. And if the enemy perceives weakness, that's where you need to be strong. And you should feign disorder when you're actually at your best. And so there's really, there's a lot of dissembly going on, but I'm not really sure what to make of that. Because I can see situations in which an earnest show of strength, for instance, in the Cold War and like the arms race, is actually much more effective than pretending that you're weaker, because isn't seeming weak a provocation, sort of like a go ahead and attack us type move, where if your object is to prevent being attacked, you might want to actually puff out your chest and seem pretty strong.
He goes all in on the deception thing. So I guess your point is very well taken. And there are a lot of contradictions in this book, I feel like, but there's nothing in there that would like back down from that, you know, feign weakness portion of it.
Which, again, just feels, you know, so antithetical to the moment we're in, where everyone seems to want to be showing strength. So I guess we're only partially executing, you know, some of what Sun Tzu advises. And there was another phrase, though, that caught my eye about, you know, maybe not necessarily feigning weakness, but not showing a sign of your strength and letting someone else's choleric temper take a hold. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that resonated with either of you, but it was like choleric temper. I've seen examples of that recently. I was like, is this a parenting guide too? Mm. But no, I'm obviously talking about someone in particular.
Right.
The seek to irritate him thing was definitely, that felt like a strategy of the Hillary. You're talking about Bernie Sanders, right?
That's
what we're talking about, a political figure who has a famous choleric temper who needed to be irritated. No, you're talking about Donald Trump. And I think precisely what you said in reading that portion, my thoughts went to a specific moment in the presidential campaign, or a series of moments, where during like big debates and big speeches and big moments like the Democratic National Convention, the Clinton campaign seemed to, at a certain point, be explicitly bringing up things that they knew would cause Trump to shoot himself in the foot and would upset him and anger him in some way. And I'm thinking of the Khazir Khan episode, where during the Democratic National Convention, they spotlighted that, and they spotlighted this family who had lost their son, and it was a Muslim family, a Muslim soldier who had died fighting for the U.S. in Iraq, and Trump just went bonkers and like started attacking this Gold Star family for no good reason. Aside from maybe his what's the term, choleric temper.
Yeah.
And
when
then
did
and
he
then
go?
Yes.
Well,
I mean, maybe HRC is a real fan too. Maybe it's anyone in DC.
Yeah. And well, and the other thing that the Trump, I mean, but then again, like this, the reality gives the lie to all of this, because guess who's president? Like, it's not Hillary Clinton. But you would think that Donald Trump would heed the no unforced errors clause in this pamphlet. Like, that was one thing that he also returned to, Sun Tzu, over and over again, was I think the words were, to secure ourselves against defeat lies in our own hands, while the opportunity of defeating the enemy is provided by the enemy himself. So you can keep yourself from falling. But by the same token, you are the person who invites the enemy into your walled gates, into your walled citadel, and who opens the gate. And it's really not within the power of the adversary to win. It's only within the power of the adversary to not lose themselves. And it seems like Trump, like with Alicia Machado, with Khazir Khan, as you said, just kept shooting himself in the foot. But somehow it worked for him, so I don't know what to make of that.
I looked it up, and he, in his book, in Donald Trump's book, which, you know, who knows if he read it, nonetheless wrote it, Trump 101, The Way to Success, one of the books that he recommends is this book, And he says, those wanting a leadership book won't be disappointed by Sue's insights into the wise general. And those wanting a treatise on business tactics can also make great use of tips on strategy and appearing to be what you're not. Do we actually think Trump ever read this book?
Like, oh, surely he just wanted to seem tough. And so he dispatched someone to look up, like, you know, writings by generals.
But
like,
we know from Sun Tzu, you're not supposed to look tough.
Right. So
how's that?
Good I don't point. Think he read it, though. Like, I agree. It's like, because it's not an easy or comfortable or fun, particularly fun read necessarily. Like you said, some of these aphorisms are quite beautiful and poetic, but a lot of them are just like weird military tactical strategies from like the 3rd century BC or whatever. And it's like, well, this you can get kind of bogged down a little bit, even though it's like the size of a pamphlet and it takes like, you know, can take very, very short period of time to read.
One of the things that strikes me about, you know, how inaccessible is kind of how lonely it must be to be this, you know, commander, general, whatever, because basically it's saying you need to be perfect. You need to be thinking 10 steps ahead. You have to keep your troops motivated. You have to be thinking about the other side. And there's also a really interesting notion that somehow the commander that is being described is separate from the sovereign. And I didn't take that to mean like a higher power. I thought it meant like king in general. And usually when you think about warlord, you kind of think about one and the same. And there were a couple of references to sovereign that really struck me. And I'm like, well, it almost seems to advocate if you need to go a different direction from your ruler. And, you know, for modern day, the analogy would be joint chief or a general vis-a-vis president, that's okay. But there's this notion of burden that this one person is supposed to be doing all this and how lonely that must be. And that, it, you know, there's such a singular sense of obligation. Like, well, who would want to be the master of this art of war? It's an expectation that I don't know who could possibly meet.
Right. It does seem like a burden. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about the difference between tactics and strategy, because that was one thing that really fascinated me. When Sun Tzu talks about these two terms, he says, all men can see the tactics whereby I conquer, but what none can see is the strategy out of which victory is evolved. Do not repeat the tactics which have gained you one victory, but let your methods be regulated by the infinite variety of circumstances. Military tactics are like unto water. For water in its natural course runs away from high places and hastens downwards. So in war, the way is to avoid what is strong and to strike at what is weak. Water shapes its course according to the nature of the ground over which it flows. What really interested me there is it seems that the strategy is constant. It's sort of this embrace of flexibility, and the tactics are sort of how the strategy manifests as it encounters the facts on the ground, the lay of the land. It seems to me like he was saying strategy is the shapeless water that is adaptive and sort of fits the mold that the land provides for it. And then the tactics are the way the water looks as it flows into a particular rivulet that's dictated by the ground. And I thought that was a really beautiful but also powerful image, especially because it reminded me actually of The Prince in Machiavelli when Machiavelli says that fortune itself is a rushing river, and what the prudent person does is erects dam structures, different diversionary built structures to direct the flow in one direction or another. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting echo of these political thinkers through time. But I guess that's a very long wind up to asking you both what you made of this distinction.
What I took away from that section was do not repeat the tactics portion. And it seems to me a very eloquent and beautiful way of saying that, you know, life is situational, conflicts are situational, and it's just like it's basic common sense, but presented in this very poetic way.
I liked it because it felt like it coincided with this notion of method and discipline and planning, in that you know, in life, and there's not one playbook that you can just apply to everything. you kind of have to assess your situation, and that's what any smart person would do in any situation, let alone whether they're fighting war or not. And I'm not surprised that he used a natural reference, as I think, since he was clearly very fascinated by topography, it was mm-hmm. a consistent theme.
Part of what interested me about it is that, you know, flip-flopping is not today a virtue. Inconsistency is not a virtue. And yet he sort of reframes it as adaptability, flexibility, malleability, some kind of wiliness. And I kind of liked the notion that not only should you conceal your specific tactics, but you should conceal your tendencies. Like, don't reveal your dispositions. Don't be predictable. Like, don't be the type of person where, now Katie will make a joke because she feels awkward. I've seen her do it 1,000 times. Like, maybe one time make a joke. The next time punch the person in the face. Just that notion that you need to not be the type of person that someone can suss out. You need to be mysterious. You need to be unpredictable. Actually made me think of Trump. Like, that's one thing that he does do well.
But it sounds so lonely, because if no one can predict you, that means that no one really knows you.
Yeah, no one understands you.
This also reminds me of, I took in college a global security class, and we had a CIA analyst or something come by and talk to us, and he said, you know, if you want to be an agent one day, which of course I obviously thought I was going to be, he was like, make sure you don't.
Are you an agent? Secret, Ava?
Yeah, I'm embedded here at Slate Magazine spying on all of you.
Oh God, she just dispatched assassins to take us out, because now we know.
Now I'm pausing because my handler is contacting me. I do like spy shows, but anyway, bad tangent. But I will say that he said to us, he said, don't walk the same, do you walk the same path to class every day? Don't do that. Like, that's, you know, was taught, and like, this was someone who literally was engaged in the art of warfare, you know, overseas, and was talking about predictability and what a liability that could be. And of course, for a couple of days, I tried to walk a different path to class, and then I got bored and I decided I didn't want to do that anymore. But yeah, I think, you know, that the notion that predictability is somehow a weakness, like you get comfortable, you let your guard down, and that's when you make mistakes. And predictability is also kind of antithetical to this notion of ultimate preparation, too, that you need to be gaming everything out as opposed to just relying on instinct and the well-worn path.
So there is this 11-dimensional chess chaos theory of this administration. And if you're looking for clues as to, you know, potential origins, Steve Bannon has allegedly, this is allegedly Steve Bannon's Bible, according to one of his former writing partners for, you know, a number of years in Los Angeles, publicly said that she described it as literally his Bible. And the upshot of that sort of, you know, disruptive perspective to tactics and politics, which I think can be seen in people said this a lot when the first travel ban came out, and it was just a nightmare. It was horrible, and it did so much damage. But it, you know, people being turned back at the airports who legally had the right to be here, people not being allowed onto airplanes who legally had the right to be here, and all this just like damage and trauma to so many people that was so visible though and caused such a backlash. But people posited at the time that, you know what, Steve Bannon, who was one of the principal architects of this policy, wants this chaos. He wants
a stress test.
This disruption, a stress test, something like that, exactly. But the upshot of this is that Sun Tzu also says, never get into protracted battles. If you get in a protracted battle, you lay siege, you're going to lose. And what this specific example of chaos caused was the great potential for a protracted battle in the courts that we're still seeing, and that they are, you know, it seemed to be losing, and they did lose because this initial, they actually backed down from this initial travel ban and are trying a new one that the courts have again rejected. But there are points in this book that if you apply them to the current political climate, you can see where the different contradictions in Sun Tzu's thinking might run into each other.
That's really fascinating. Just to switch gears a little bit, I wonder if we, I mean, Ava, you brought up the natural metaphors or the imagery from the natural world. And it did strike me that was something that he kept referring to. He has lines like, I keep confusing them with the lines from the Mulan song, I'll make a man out of you, you must be swift as a coursing river. But he says, let your rapidity be that of the wind, your compactness that of the forest. And he goes on in that way for a while. But these kinds of, I saw them as almost stylistic frills because they don't seem designed to really teach you or be revelatory. They seem like just demonstrations that he is wise and because he can invoke the natural world and sort of have this this greater perspective that's sort of like extra human in that it's, sorry, outside of human, that we should heed his advice. And it almost made me wonder if this was sort of the 6th century Chinese version of truthiness. If you can if you can mention rocks and stones and trees, then you must know whereof you speak, and you must speak true things.
The moment we got to nature, he kind of lost me, city child of the city that I am. But I, too, was trying to wonder what he's doing, because he went from these like very, you know, grand, high level, almost essentialist notions, and then suddenly is on this very specific level. Like, well, make sure you attack this way in this quadrant of land. It was so foreign and it seems so specific. I was like, what's going on here? I know you like your lists, Sun Tzu, and like nature seems like a great opportunity to list things out. Here are various things we see in nature, but it was the same feeling for me. It kind of didn't blend. I'm almost wondering if there were multiple authors here.
That's a really interesting question. I didn't think of that. There was sort of like the monk who was sitting and observing the beauty of his surroundings, and then Sun Tzu who's saying, all right, but how do you set someone on fire?
Here is the method.
Yeah. I think there's a theory in my reading of this that it might not have been a single author. It might have been a collection of military advice. And, you know, Sun Tzu, while possibly a historical figure, may not have been the author of this. And that would explain that. But I haven't dug down into the scholarship of this enough to know which is the right answer. I think, though, it's an open question.
I tend to prefer great man theories. I find them kind of more inspiring, that one great person like was just so brilliant, and we can thus all aspire to that kind of brilliance. But
yeah, who doesn't want to try to be like Sun Tzu? Everybody, right?
No, I don't think so. I think that's what we're unpacking. That we don't. The art of deception. No, I don't like
also
it one bit.
Also, so that makes sense to me, because for someone who is so very against transparency and even has a, what is like the one, he says like, oh, divine art of secrecy and subtlety. And then the next, literally the next bullet point is like, if the enemy is standing across from you, staring at you angrily, that is a time for increased vigilance. And I'm like, oh,
yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Captain Obvious. Like, I think that is when I would go inside my tent and be like, nothing to see here, nothing to worry about. So there is, I do think that he states the obvious a lot, and then he prizes nuance and secrecy and slipperiness, and it doesn't all quite cohere.
Which kind of begs the question, who's the intended audience here? Is it for wards and training, or is he thinking about, you know, just the normal pleb who maybe should get some insight into his genius and their leader's genius, and why should they should just accept the strategy?
It would definitely have been generals, right? It's got to be generals, but like,
but a general should already know this.
Well, you're right, because it so much of it is kind of feels like vague and intuitive, but at the same time, it. A lot of it was presented in a very, you know,
instructional
kind of, instructional and kind of beautiful way. And at the same time, here's one that like it made me, you know, be like, well, which one? What's going on here? Though we have heard of stupid haste in war, cleverness has not been seen associated with long delays. Which one is it? It make up your mind, Sun Tzu. It can't be both. Maybe it's a happy
medium. You know,
you have to adapt your strategy and you have to adapt your tactics. See, this I'm bad on strategy and tactics. Either way, you have to adapt to something.
So, no, Sun Tzu, just tell me what to do. I just want to know which one it is. I guess you're right, though. Oh, he does say so when he says it's a situational. That's true. Crap.
Oh, my God. I've mastered the art of war. Wow.
Ava's winning
you got the diploma.
Ava, you won the podcast.
Yeah.
I should say mwahaha.
Yeah. One last thing. I did enjoy that for all his hammering home the point that no matter that you can't have fixed rules, this is all fluid, strategy is all fluid. There are certain things that always hold. For instance, marsh warfare, mountain warfare, and river warfare. He basically says the secret to these things are don't do them ever. So
noted.
If you would like to conduct war in a river, in a flowing stream, which may be a metaphor for fate or your own strategy, depending on who you're reading, do not do that. You should always fight someone on level ground or if you are flowing downhill, if your host is going downhill towards so you can work up momentum towards the other army. I did appreciate those hard and fast rules that he just tossed off with no ceremony whatsoever. Like that entire section was like three sentences long and it was great.
I enjoyed references to drums.
Oh, yeah. That was actually pretty cool when he said that the reason that we have flags and banners is to focus the many eyes of the army, of our army, as if they were one eye on one object. And the reason that we have drums is to focus the many ears of all the soldiers as if they were one ear on one object. I thought that was interesting and lovely.
I like that a lot too, but again, there's not really much practical use for it in today's world, business, politics, or otherwise, I don't think. But it was fun. I liked it.
Although, the Women's March in New York, there was a really cool band at one point, great drums, and the energy changes. I mean, usually I would think, you know, I would be very skeptical of something. Oh, you know, being together as a group is so hokey, so now we have to add in music too. But it was really, really powerful. So maybe it's hard because how many of us have been in the context where these things would really matter to us? So I don't want to poo-poo it entirely. Or maybe I just want to argue with Jeremy.
And I think, you know, symbolically, there's something to the idea that one spirit animates all the many different pieces, you know, all the many people participating in a movement, that there's a solidarity that's transcending the individual. And that is definitely something that has lasted beyond the 6th century BCE. So I think maybe I'd like to go around and just ask you guys whether you would recommend this book to a friend trying to make it in the jungle that is 2017 America.
So can I tell the story of how we decided to read this book as a group?
Sure.
Which was on an internal, you know, messaging conversation on Slack. There was a prompt, you know, what were things we thought that would be true in the Trump administration or would kind of change about life during the Trump administration or the things that kind of hadn't been true before. And I kind of sarcastically threw out a few ideas, one of which was the sales of The Art of War would skyrocket. Everyone ignored me, which I'm accustomed to and was totally appropriate, except for Jeremy, who immediately, you know, sent me a message privately and said, I just bought it. And I said, that's so funny. You know, we should... He said, I haven't read it yet. And I was like, I haven't read it yet either. And the only way I will is if I have some kind of formal commitment to it. So I said, let's do a book club. And then I was like, better yet,
let's do an audiobook club.
So for those of you who don't necessarily have an audiobook club at your disposal to help you maintain your commitments, I would say.
In which case, what are you doing?
What are you doing with your life, people? I would say, like, go through it with a friend and it's like, have fun with it because, you know, it is a an iconic piece. Literature seems like the wrong word, but it is, you know, it's part of that canon. And it does seem to inform a lot of things that happen day-to-day life, whether it comes to negotiation or there are a lot of themes from kind of management theory that I noticed coming up a little bit in here. And, you know, do it with a friend. Don't be lonely like the generals or the commanders. Find a friend. And then you can go around telling people for the rest of your life, you know, I've read this. Because I feel like this is one of those books where I'm like, oh, yeah, The Art of War. But very few people have actually read it. And at cocktail parties, you will actually, you know what's going on. And you
the
definitely
art
want to be that
cocktail
person.
Cocktail parties.
Yeah,
is really
that book is probably a lot better.
Yeah.
But, you know, who does? You can just be that guy or that gal at a cocktail party.
Excellent. What about you, Jeremy?
Yeah, this is definitely a good. Be the person who knows The Art of War, reference 17, chapter 3 at the cocktail party and its applicability to acquiring cocktail wieners or whatever in that situation. But I think that that's the only context in which I would recommend this book is if you want to have that base of knowledge, you want to have read this iconic thing and you want to be able to have it in the back of your mind at times to reference maybe and be kind of smart. But I, as an enjoyable kind of thing to spend, you know, a break in your afternoon doing, I don't know that I would recommend this as a particularly fun read. There were lovely points and, you know, beautiful descriptions, but we just mentioned most of them, I feel like. So just listen to this podcast.
Totally good.
And if you have to like read it, maybe listen to, I found the British audiobook on YouTube, very sonorous and pleasant and just enjoyable. In a way that maybe actually reading the words and like going back and thinking, if I want to really take this in, I had to reread a few points and it was kind of frustrating to me and annoying to me. And the book club, you can just kind of, it's like white noise. I feel like if that's what you want to do, do that. Or if you want to like be smart at the cocktail party, do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I fall somewhere in between you two. I can see a situation where you are at the cocktail party, you are a little bit intoxicated, and suddenly it seems profoundly meaningful to you that a chariot raises a different type of dust cloud than a group of infantrymen.
I want to go to
and
that
suddenly,
party.
Yeah, and like suddenly you just realize that this part of the pamphlet distinguishing between those types of dust clouds is very beautifully meaningful and symbolic in some way. That might be an experience that you want to have. On the other hand, yeah, I'm not sure how enjoyable it is to read. I'm also not sure how much I want a whole bunch of people to walk around having imbibed these lessons about how you should have no principles and just adapt yourself to the circumstance and put men in desperate straits so that they feel like they have nothing to lose and must surrender their souls to you. Doesn't seem like the most nice thing to do to your fellow people. But yeah, you know, if you've got a free moment, why not? It's short.
I like that headline, The Art of War, Not a Nice Book.
Very unfair, bad, sad, not nice. all right. Well, thank you guys so much for joining me. This was super fun.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
The homepage for the Slate Book Review is slate.com/books. You'll find the show pages for this and every episode of the Audiobook Club at slate.com/ABC. Visit our Facebook page where you can leave a comment on this episode. That address is facebook.com/slateABC. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, which helps other people discover the show. Search for Slate Audiobook Club in the iTunes store and don't forget to leave a comment while you're there. Slate's Audiobook Club is part of the Panoply Network. Find out more about all of our great podcasts at panoply.fm. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch, and thanks for the assist, Dan Bloom. Slate's executive producer is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is our chief content officer. For Jeremy Stahl and Ava Lubell, I'm Katie Waldman. Thanks for listening.